People often ask me, why is it that you wrote this book? Why did you pick this subject, Collapse, for your next book? And the answer is simple. It was the most fascinating and also the most important subject that I could think about to write on. It's fascinating to reflect on societies that left behind as monuments abandoned cities in the jungle or in the desert. All of us, I think, like me, as teenagers or in our early 20s or 30s, we see National Geographic specials, we see photographs of the abandoned Maya cities in the jungle, of the abandoned Anasazi skyscrapers in the desert, and we ask ourselves, why did these people build cities in a place where today nobody is making a living, and why, having gone to all the effort of building these great monuments, did they abandon them? And might they hold any lesson for us today? Is there anything that we can learn from these past failures? Might it be the case that by the end of this century, people will look back on the abandoned skyscrapers of Portland and Los Angeles and London and ask why people erected those cities? So there's the fascination, but also the importance, the question whether we can extract any lessons from the past that would help us confront the problems that we face today. Do we really have to repeat the same mistakes as the past, or can we learn anything of use from these societies that tragically collapsed? My book then started out as a set of romantic mysteries to understand past collapses. And so chapter 2, and I'll tell you in a moment what chapter 1 is, discusses the collapse of Easter Island Polynesian society, which I'll tell you a bit more about. There's also a section on the collapse of Pitcairn Island society before the Bounty Mutineers, on the collapse of the most advanced civilization of the New World before Columbus, the Maya cities of the Yucatan Peninsula, the collapse closest to us Americans, namely the Anasazi collapse in the deserts of the Four Corner regions of Arizona, New Mexico, Colorado, and Utah, and then a European collapse, that of the Greenland Norse. But then I realized it's not at all the case that all past societies have been doomed to collapse. There are many parts of the world where human societies have been going on for thousands of years, or even 10,000s of years, without any sign of collapse. And so the book is not just a depressing account of failures, it's an account of failures and successes, and an attempt to understand why some people solved their problems while other people did not solve their problems. Hence I discuss Iceland, for a long time the poorest country in Europe, the most environmentally ravaged country in Europe, and now the seventh richest country in the world. I discuss Japan of the Tokugawa era, which I'll tell you a bit more about this evening, the New Guinea Highlands, one of the great success stories of the world, where people have been going on for 46,000 years, and Tikapia and Tonga Islands in the Pacific. All that makes up half the book. And then finally I realized that I can't stop after discussing successes or failures in the past. There are many gripping cases at present. There are societies in the world that have already collapsed, where states have failed and where people have been killing each other. There are also societies in dire trouble today and others that seem to be getting along well. Therefore, half of the book is about the modern world. Chapter 1, initially the book was going to begin with a past society, Easter Island, but then I realized it would be distancing and exotic for Americans and Europeans if I began with Polynesians, because then my readers might say, well, these stupid mistakes were made only by Polynesians and Native Americans and other people. Just to show that there are environmental problems, even in what seems to be the most pristine part of the richest country in the world. My chapter one is not on Oregon, but very close to it. Montana, the American state of the 48, lower 48, with the lowest population density, the most pristine environment, and yet you scratch the surface in Montana, has all the environmental and population problems of the rest of the world. There's a chapter on Rwanda, a horrifying failure, a country that solved its population and environmental problems in 1994 when 6 million Rwandans killed 1 million Rwandans. Another chapter on a controlled experiment, the island of Hispaniola in the Caribbean near Cuba, divided into two countries, Haiti and the Dominican Republic, failure and success side by side. Haiti, the poorest country of the New World, one of the saddest basket cases of the world. And on the same island, the Dominican Republic, a struggling third world country but still 8 times richer than Haiti, an exporter of avocados and of great baseball players. What can we learn from this contrast within the same island? There's a chapter on China, the world's biggest country, in terms of population. What happens in China affects 1,300,000,000 people, but also China is so big that what happens in China inevitably affects the rest of the world. And there's also a chapter on Australia, the first world country with the most fragile environment, the most severe problems, but also contemplating the most drastic solutions. In trying to understand why societies fail or succeed, I eventually arrived at a 5-point framework. In no particular order, one of those 5 items is the impact of people on their environment. Sometimes people hammer away at the environmental resources on which they depend, such as their water and their soil and their forests and their fish, and hammer away until the resources on which they depend are undermined, thereby inadvertently destroying the society. Item 2 on my checklist is climate change. Today we think of global warming caused by humans, but in the past climate has been changing for reasons unrelated to humans. The climate has gotten colder or warmer or drier or rainier, and climate change interacts with human hammering of the environment. A society can get away with hammering the environment sometimes as long as the climate is in its favor, and then when it gets cold or dry, the society can no longer cope. The third factor on my 5-point checklist is relations with hostile neighbors. Most societies have neighbors with some of which they're intermittently at war, and when a society gets weakened for any reason, such as its own internal problems, that's the occasion when the enemy are likely to take advantage of weakness and walk in on the society. That very likely was part of the explanation for the fall of the Western Roman Empire, which had its own political and economic and military problems, and there were always barbarians at the gates, but when Rome got weak, the barbarians took advantage and conquered a weakened Rome. Item 4 on my checklist is friendly trade partners. Almost every society depends upon other societies for some essential materials, just as the United States depends upon other societies for oil, fish, and other essentials. But if your trade partner gets weakened and collapses, that may cause a collapse of your own society, even if you do not face major problems of your own. Americans can think of the 1973-74 Gulf oil crisis, which did not cause us to collapse, but certainly gave us a scare, and would have caused severe trouble if it had gone on. And then finally, the 5th and last item on my checklist is a society's political, economic, cultural, and social responses. Societies always face problems. Why do some societies respond by solving those problems, while others respond by failing to solve the problems? Just to give you a flavor for these stories from the past and the present, and all of them, because they involve human beings and their fates, they're all gut-wrenching stories. Let me start with the case of Easter Island. Easter is the most remote habitable scrap of land in the world, small island, about 50 square miles, 2,300 miles west of the coast of Chile, 1,300 miles east of the nearest inhabited Polynesian island. Easter was settled by Polynesians coming from the west around AD 800. And it's famous. I'm sure that many or most of you have seen the photographs in the National Geographic specials of the giant stone statues up to 70 feet tall and weighing up to 270 tons that these people without draft animals or wheels or mechanized transport or machines or steel tools somehow carved, dragged up to 10 miles and then erected, mounted vertically on platforms facing inwards from the sea. And yet when, after Europeans discovered Easter Island in 1722, the islanders then were already in the process of tearing down and breaking the statues that their ancestors had erected at such enormous effort. Why? Also, when Europeans arrived in 1722, the island was an utterly treeless landscape, the last place that you would expect a complex society to arise. Already, the Dutch navigator Jacob Roggeveen, the European who, quotes, discovered Easter Island, meaning found it teeming with Polynesians, Roggeveen asked himself, how on earth on an island that doesn't have any trees, erecting and transporting these statues must have taken timber for sleds or rollers or whatever, and rope to drag them and erect them. But this island has no trees, no source of timber or rope. How on earth could they have transported the statues? The explanation for these romantic mysteries, romantic and tragic mysteries of Easter Island, has come out of archaeological studies of the last 20 years, which show that when the Polynesians arrived in AD 800, the island was not a treeless wasteland, but it was covered with a subtropical forest that included the world's biggest palm tree. And the settlers proceeded to chop down trees for the usual reasons, to clear land for their gardens and farming, to have trees to build canoes with which to go out to sea and harpoon tuna and dolphins, for firewood, for construction timber, and then to make the sleds and levers and rollers and rope with which to transport and erect the statues. They went on chopping down trees until sometime around the year 1650, all the trees on the island had been chopped down and there were no trees left. At that point, they could no longer transport or erect statues. They also had no more wood for canoes. They couldn't go out to sea to fish, and that left them with only without tuna or dolphin. They then had only one big animal as source of meat, humans. Easter Island society collapsed in an epidemic of cannibalism. The government of the chiefs was overthrown. A new military class took over the island. The 12 clans fought against each other. Each clan would tear down each other's statues in such a way as to break them at the neck. And the fighting went on until by the year 1843, about 90% of Easter's original population had died. And all of the statues, all of those hundreds of stone statues erected at such monumental effort had been thrown down and broken. Easter Island is as close as we get in history to a pure environmental collapse because the island was so isolated. There were no problems of enemies. There were no problems, issues of friends. There's no evidence for the role of climate change. Instead, that island destroyed itself by hammering away at its environment. Of all the stories of past collapses, Easter Island collapse is, I found, the one that grabs people most because the metaphor is so clear. My students at UCLA recognize Easter Island, isolated in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. When the islanders got into trouble, there was nowhere, no other people to whom they could turn for help. There was no other place to which they could flee. And Easter Island, they see as a metaphor for the planet Earth today, our globalized world. If we mess up our world as Easter Island has messed up Easter Island, we too will not have any green extraterrestrials out there to help us, and there's no place to which we can flee. Easter Island is a metaphor. Chapter 3 is about another Polynesian island, Pitcairn Island, famous for the bounty mutineers who arrived in 1790. But when the mutineers arrived, they found temples and platforms indicating that the island had previously been settled and abandoned by Polynesians. The collapse, the complete die-off of Polynesian society on Pitcairn, was due to the Polynesian equivalent of a Gulf oil crisis. The Polynesians of Easter depended on imports from a bigger island called Mangareva, and Mangareva underwent an environmental collapse, deforestation, cannibalism. The canoes from Mangareva stopped going out when the trees of Mangareva had been cut down and when the Mangarevans were fighting each other in dead earnest. And when the canoes stopped coming with the essential imports to Pitcairn Island, all the Pitcairn Islanders ended up dead. The Greenland Norse are a European society that collapsed. If you think that these things could happen only to Polynesians or Native Americans, it can happen to blonde-haired, blue-eyed Europeans. Around the year 1000, Norwegians, Vikings from Norway, went out and settled Greenland, that big northern island, and they set up what was the most remote outpost of Europe, a Christian European society with stone churches and a great stone cathedral, maintaining a dairying economy based on cows, sheep, and goats, and writing in Latin and in Norse runes, and paying regular church tithes. The Greenland Norse carried on for 450 years, which is longer than the survival so far of European society in North America. And eventually, around 1450, they ended up all dead because of all five of the factors on my checklist. They too deforested and they had problems of soil erosion. There was climate change, it got colder. They had enemies, the Inuit, or Eskimos. They lost their friendly trading partner, mainland Norway, which stopped sending out ships because Norway itself had problems and got weak. And then finally, the responses of the Greenland Norse were fatal and maladaptive. As European Christians, the Norse despised the Inuit, refused to learn from the Inuit, fought with the Inuit, in particular, refused to learn how to fish and how to hunt ringed seals from the Inuit. And so the Norse starved to death amidst abundant food that the Inuit were using. Greenland is like a chemistry test tube experiment, two test tubes, the experiment and the control. In the case of Greenland, two human societies. Yes, you may say Greenland is a difficult environment, but people can survive there. The Inuit inherited Greenland and they're still there today. The Inuit made choices that let them survive. The Norse made fatal choices. Those, then, are some of the past societies that I discuss. I also discuss cases of successes. I mentioned before, briefly, Japan. Japan of the Tokugawa era in the 1600s solved the same forestry problems that did in the Mangarevans and the Easter Islanders and the Greenland Norse and the Maya civilization of the Yucatan Peninsula. In the 1600s, Japan's 150-year civil war came to an end. There was peace and prosperity, population boom, construction of big palaces and wooden cities which burned down so they had to be reconstructed. And gradually it became clear that Japan was getting deforested. But in this case, the government took corrective action. The shoguns, the so-called Tokugawa shoguns, saw that Japan was being deforested, and they solved Japan's forestry problems by both negative and positive measures. The negative measures included various measures to ration the use of wood, such as switching to coal for fuel and constructing houses of lighter timber. And the positive measures consisted of developing modern scientific plantation forestry. It's often thought that modern scientific forestry began in Germany and Europe, but it developed independently in Japan. There were forestry manuals in Japan of the late 1600s describing how to plant seedlings and prepare the seed bed and how to thin them out and how to grow them and when to harvest them. And in that way, Japan both decreased wood consumption and increased wood production to the point where today Japan is the first world country covered most extensively with forest. Although Japan is the most densely populated major first world country, three-quarters of Japan today is forested. Until 1850, Japan was self-sufficient in wood. Here's a country that solved its forestry problems. In working on my book, I've encountered some surprises. For the past couple of years, as a trial run for the book, I've been teaching a course based on it to my undergraduate students at UCLA. And as I describe to my students these societies that collapse and fail to solve their problems, they caught on to the significance of something that I had overlooked. My students asked me, why on earth did these people do these dumb things like destroying their environment and allowing soil erosion to accumulate? Why didn't they see what was happening? Why didn't they anticipate and solve their problems? What did the Easter Islander who cut down the last palm tree on Easter Island say as he was doing it? Surely they noticed it. It's a surprisingly complicated question. Why do groups of people inadvertently make fatal mistakes that destroy them? That's why the subtitle of my book is Collapse: How Societies Choose to Fail or Succeed. Obviously, no society really chooses to fail, but societies do make choices, like the Greenland Norse. And those choices may turn out as condemning the society to failure. So how does a society get into such severe trouble? Turns out to be complicated. In some cases, a society fails to anticipate a problem. For example, because the problem is unprecedented in the society's experience. We Americans have good experience with that. Global warming. Until 30 years ago, there had been no case of global warming due to human actions in history. And since this was unknown and inconceivable, we did not anticipate global warming 30 years ago. A society may fail as a result of failing to notice a problem when it appears. Some problems are literally imperceptible, such as salinization, the destruction of good farmland by soil invisible within the ground being brought up by farming practices, or again, global warming. Why is it that it took us 30 years to become convinced of the reality of global warming? Why did scientists argue about it? And why is it that finally today it's taken 30 years for all but two of the governments in the world, Australia and one other that I won't mention, to acknowledge the reality of global warming? It's simple. It's not the case that each year was 1 degree warmer than the previous year. Temperature fluctuates. It's warmer one summer, and then it gets colder and colder, and then warmer, colder. So there were ups and downs, and it took about 20 or 30 years before the trend became sufficiently clear that all scientists, all climatologists concerned with these issues now accept the reality of global warming and accept that humans are a major causal factor. The term landscape amnesia or creeping normalcy is sometimes applied to these problems that creep up on us and so are hard to notice. Societies may also fail even to try to solve a problem that they perceive. And that's perhaps the most puzzling failure of all. Isn't it incredible that people should see something going wrong around them and not even try to solve the problem? But it turns out there are many reasons why that's the case. There may be conflicts of interest. There are problems whose creation enriches some people while being bad for the rest of society. Or there are problems which are in the interests, maintaining the problem is in the interests of the governing elite, although not of the rest of society. There are also problems which we don't solve because they conflict with deeply held values, such as religious values. For example, one of the largest mining companies in the United States, which is also one of the worst polluters of the American environment, is a company whose directors belong to a subgroup of a church that believes that the world is going to come to an end in 10 years. And if the world is going to come to an end in 10 years, then you really don't have to worry about dumping all that copper, arsenic, and cadmium into the environment because the world will be at an end before those toxins produce their negative side effects. That may seem pathetic or funny, but there are many past societies that have destroyed themselves inadvertently because of conflicts with deeply held values. So those are some of the reasons why I was surprised to discover that people do not solve seemingly obvious problems around them. That was one surprise. The other surprise in working on my book had to do with the role of big businesses. Until about 7 years ago, I, like many people, thought of big businesses as being among the most destructive forces in the modern world today, as far as the environment is concerned. Big businesses as being concerned only with the bottom line, pursuing their own self-interest, and being shameless about damaging the environment if they can make money by doing so. And in many cases, this is true. But I've also learned that there are also big businesses that take much more scrupulous care of the environment than any government or even than any national park system, because they found that it helps their bottom line to do so. They save money by doing so. For example, in 1998, as a director of World Wildlife Fund, one of the big international environmental organizations, I was sent out to the producing oil fields of the country of Papua New Guinea, managed by one of the big international oil companies, Chevron Texaco. And I'd seen messy oil fields before with oil spills and flares. I didn't expect much out of Chevron oil fields, and it therefore came as a shock to me to find that the Chevron oil fields in Papua New Guinea were in much better shape than any national park in the Pacific. This company was taking really scrupulous care of the environment. If you want to see a rare endangered bird or mammal in New Guinea, go into the Chevron oil fields. It really puzzled me. I had free opportunity to talk with Chevron employees, and I was allowed to drive around anywhere I wanted myself. And eventually I discovered that there are about 8 good reasons why Chevron found that they could save money by taking good care of the environment. One is that by spending $several million a year on these environmental controls, they reduced the risk of a $4 billion disaster like the Exxon Valdez oil spill or the Santa Barbara Channel oil blowout or the Point Arguello oil field problem off Santa Barbara that Chevron itself had experienced. So it was very cost-effective to take care of the environment. Another reason is that oil company employees tend to be educated, many of them are geologists and engineers. They're people who care about the environment, and when they see a well-cared-for environment around them, it keeps their morale up, they're likely to re-enlist, and they're expensive people to train and send out there. Also, Papua New Guinea is a vigorous democracy, and if New Guineans saw their own environment being messed up, they would immediately close down the oil pipeline and shut down the oil field. By taking scrupulous care of the environment, therefore, Chevron minimized the risk that they would be closed down by the local people. And there were 4 or 5 other reasons, all of which meant that Chevron made money rather than lost money by taking care of the environment. Since then, I've gotten involved in learning more about mining companies and logging companies and fishing companies, and it turns out that in some cases they're as bad as I had thought, and in some cases they take incredibly good care of the environment. The reasons are complicated. We consumers, if we want to alter the behavior of big businesses, we have to do our homework and understand what it is that motivates big businesses. Often it's rather complicated. For example, within the United States, platinum palladium mining is operated very cleanly. In Montana, the Stillwater Platinum Palladium Mine invites in Trout Unlimited to monitor the fishing streams there, to the utter astonishment of Trout Unlimited. Coal miners in the United States aren't as clean as the platinum palladium miners, but they're much cleaner than they were 30 years ago, and copper miners in the United States, by and large, deserve their bad reputation. There are differences between platinum palladium, coal, and copper mining that account for these differences in behavior. And we consumers who want to change the behavior of the dirty industries, we have to do our homework and understand why they behave the way they do and what we can do to influence them. That was a big surprise for me. What it meant was that the behavior of big businesses is the ultimate responsibility of us, the public. It's no good to say those big businesses are to blame. The fact is that we, the public, ultimately control their behavior by buying or by not buying and by electing representatives who pass laws and regulations that make it either profitable or unprofitable for big businesses to behave as they do. People ask me what are the lessons of my book for our present situation. One of the obvious lessons is take good care of your environment and your population problems, because many past societies destroyed themselves, and we today, there are more of us and we got more potent technology. If 20,000 Easter Islanders with stone tools could ruin their environment, 6.5 billion modern people with bulldozers and steel tools can do it even more rapidly and are doing so. That's one lesson. Don't laugh off problems of the environment and population. But there are a couple of deeper lessons, which I appreciated only towards the end of the work on my book. One has to do with the role of the elite, the political power brokers in a society. In the past, comparing successful and failed societies, it's been a recipe for failure if the elite are able to insulate themselves from the consequences of their actions. And conversely, societies that are successful at solving their problems tend to be ones in which the elite suffer from the consequences of their own actions. For example, the Maya kings. Why on earth did the Maya kings in the Yucatan Peninsula permit deforestation and soil erosion to go on in a way that ultimately destroyed the society and led to the overthrow of the kings themselves? And a big part of the reason was that the kings for a long time could insulate themselves, living in their royal palace compounds and taxing the commoners, so that while the commoners were getting malnourished and starving, the kings themselves were still well-nourished until it was too late. couple of contrasting examples in the modern world. One of the things that worries me in the United States today is what seems to me within even the last decade to be an increasing insularization of the elite from the consequences of their actions. And I'm not talking just about the Enron phenomenon. In Southern California, around where I live in Los Angeles, increasingly we have gated communities, wealthy communities, in which affluent people live behind gates. They have private security guards rather than depending on the police. They drink bottled water rather than municipal water supply. The kids go to private schools rather than public schools. They depend upon their private pension plans rather than Social Security, and depend upon private health insurance rather than Medicare. That means that they're insulated from problems of public schools and Medicare and Social Security and the police force and municipal water support. They don't feel the consequences. They personally are not immediately affected by their failure to solve these problems, and in the past that's been a blueprint for trouble. Conversely, when I look at the countries in the modern world that seem to be most successful at dealing with their environmental population problems, they include the Netherlands and Scandinavia. These are countries in which the elite are least insulated or can't insulate themselves from the consequences of their action. For example, the Netherlands, I had known that the Netherlands is the country in the world of which the highest percentage of its citizens, nearly a half, belong to environmental organizations. And I never understood why until in 1999 I was on a trip to the Netherlands and I went around birdwatching with my Netherlands birdwatching friends. And I asked them, why do so many of you Dutch belong to environmental organizations? And they said, Jared, look around you. This land here that we're driving through, it's below sea level. It's what we call a polder. It was sub-sea level land. It was bay of the sea that was drained and dikes were erected around it. And we pumped out the sea. And that was what the windmills used to be for, but now we do it with power-driven pumps. But one-third of the Netherlands is below sea level, protected by dikes, and you see the dikes out there. But it's not the case that in the Netherlands the rich people live up on top of the dikes and the poor people live down in the drained polders. Rich and poor alike live down in the polders. And the politicians know that if the water system fails, they're going to drown along with everybody else. And we Dutch remember, this is something I remember too, because I was 16 years old when it happened. Holland has invested billions and billions of dollars in a system of dikes to protect the country. There's a country where the elite cannot insulate themselves from the consequences of their actions and so are motivated to solve everybody's problems. That's a deep lesson. And the other deep lesson I want to mention has to do with core values. One of the most difficult things for a society in solving its problems is to reappraise the values that have been the source of its identity and the source of its strength in the past, when those values, because of change conditions, have become no longer adaptive. The Greenland Norse, for example, it was okay to be European Christians. That was the source of their strength. That was how these 5,000 Norwegians out in Greenland, a week's dangerous sea journey from Norway, maintained their sanity and cooperated with each other and built up a functioning European society. It was the source of their strength until the Inuit arrived in Greenland and the trade with Norway got cut off. And at that point, to consider yourself a European Christian and to despise the pagan Inuit, the Eskimos, proved fatal. The Norwegian Christians in Greenland refused to learn from the pagan Inuit, and as a result, they starved to death. The values that had preserved them for 450 years finally turned against them. Reappraising core values, then, is difficult and painful. But there are societies that have done it. I lived in Europe, in England, from 1958 to 1962, and that was the time when Britain was undergoing a painful reappraisal of core values. For many centuries, Britain's identity was wrapped up in being the leaders of the greatest empire that the world had ever known. And then in 1956 came the failed Suez invasion, and the British had to face up to the fact that they were no longer an independently acting world power. It was very painful, and I saw it going on in Britain in the late 50s and 60s, and they were struggling against changing Britain's identity. But eventually, Britain has changed its identity, and the British now identify themselves with Europe, and they are part of the European Union, and no longer view themselves with this out-of-date values, being the head of the world's most powerful empire. Here was a country that successfully changed their core values. Again, in the United States, we today face a couple of core values that need reappraisal. Historically, we have thrived by our isolationism and by our